Good afternoon, and welcome to KALW's weekly magazine of Most Things Culturally Considered, Open Air. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, conversations with the chief designer of the new Exploratorium, Mark Letalian, with Michael Fabiano, who is singing in the Beethoven programs with the San Francisco Symphony, and with David Barlow, starring in the title role of Berkeley Rep's production of Pericles. Plus, with the recent opening of Feinstein's at the Nikko, Peter Robinson will be offering a brief history of cabaret. Stay with us. Well, let's start with drama, because after all, the play's the thing. Appropriately enough, my first guest is actor David Barlow, who's starring in the title role of Berkeley Rep's production of Pericles, Prince of Tyre, now through May 26th. David has appeared on the stages off-Broadway, at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and all around the country in contemporary and standard repertory plays, on TV in roles on Third Watch, Without a Trace, and even All My Children. And this marks his Berkeley Rep debut, and quite a role it is. David, welcome to KLW.
Thank you, David.
Pericles, Prince of Tyre, not the first Shakespeare play that trips off the tongue. And in fact, scholars have questioned how much is actually from the pen of the bard.
Yes, there's so much discrepancy and debate over who actually really wrote this one. People tend to think that the first two acts were written by someone else, perhaps a man named George Wilkins. Lesser known writer, to be sure, and the quality of the writing really is different between acts 1 and 2 and then 3, 4, and 5, where at least Harold Bloom, was the celebrated writer, thinks Shakespeare really picked up the play.
Mm-hmm. So the original dates from about 1607 or 8 around there, I understand.
Yes. You might know better than I do. I should know that.
But is it because of this questionable authenticity that maybe the director, Mark Wing Davey, felt he could have a little bit of license with the text?
I think it definitely gives Mark a lot more license, though Mark, to be sure, would take as much license as he ever felt he needed, regardless of the play. But this particular play, because it's in so many different locations and even time periods, lends itself to that kind of, those kinds of liberties. Mm-hmm. It needs a director like Mark, who's going to really have some fun with it. Because since it isn't Lear or Hamlet or doesn't delve deeply into human psychology in the way that those plays do, It needs a different kind of tack.
Mm-hmm. Now, how does this version then compare with the original Shakespeare that you might check out of the library?
This is a cut, and so much, it's so pared down. When we first read it around the table, it read it about an hour and 14 minutes. And so Mark had really streamlined it. We still play it, though, at 2 hours, because we just fill all the moments, like the giant storm scene.
We'll talk about that in a minute.
Yes. We definitely make hay where the sun shines in a sex scene. Uh-huh.
Which doubles as the boat.
Which doubles as the boat, yes.
It's actually classified in Shakespeare's works as a comedy, but boy, do you go through some angst and drama, not only your character, but your physical person. I mean, as we alluded to, there's a tempest scene on the waters, and when I first saw the fire hose being toted out and knowing that you're on a boat, I thought, no, are they really going to do that? And then I saw the fire hose thicken up as the water went through it, and sure enough, the entire stage and everyone on that boat doubling as a mattress in another scene was thoroughly soaked. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah, we get blasted to hell with water, which I love, because as an actor, I get to deal with something that's really happening. It's so great, and that's another thing I appreciate about Mark's direction, is that he wants to deal with fact-based things. Like, okay, we all know that that's not a boat, but it's just a plank of wood that's on these springs. But what you're really seeing is the performers have to wrestle with the fact that they're moving all over the place, they're getting shot with a water cannon and dealing with real elements. And on top of that, telling a story. So it's exciting.
The staging is what I like to call non-distracting contemporary.
Okay.
It's not, you know, the formal robes that you'd see in a Shakespeare play or the tights or the wigs.
Which
or
for me is distracting.
Okay, there you go. And as you said, we see these very real elements that you can see the deus ex machina for the most part, what's going on behind the scenes.
Well, there's a real deus ex machina in this production.
That's
that crane that comes around that's always dropping in an actual boat motor that the fishermen are tinkering on, and then a goddess and a woman who's been abducted and thrown into a pirate's webbed, I don't know what you call that thing, but they throw her into this netting, and then she's lifted up 15 feet off the ground.
It all works really well, yeah. I must say. Now, tell us more about working with Mark Wing Davey, no stranger to Berkeley Rep, this being his fifth appearance at Berkeley Rep, and having directed Angels in America at ACT. What's it like working with Mark?
I love working with Mark. This is my third time. I worked with him the first time when I was a student at the NYU Graduate Acting Program, of which now he's the head of,
right.
But he was just a visiting director when I was there. And then many years passed, and I reunited with him a year ago at the Actors Theater of Louisville doing a show, and now here. And what I consider him a teacher of mine in the theater, because I've just learned so much about... Like, when we start the day in a rehearsal room with Mark, it first of all starts off with something called koosh ball. And he has all the actors and whoever else is in the room line up on two sides of a net. And we play a game of koosh ball, which is insanely competitive.
Okay.
People just get berserk about this. But what he's doing is he's just kind of like he's setting the day off. Getting everyone out of their heads, into their bodies, so that when you begin the work, you're beginning very much in the moment. He doesn't know exactly what is going to happen that day. So you have to come in ready to explore, ready to be able to make as many spontaneous discoveries as possible. So I love the fact that he trusts his actors and he trusts himself to not know. He certainly has a framework and a vision for what he wants, but doesn't know how he's going to get there.
Hmm.
And really trusts the people that he's chosen to collaborate with to find that place with him.
So the production isn't fully formed in his mind and you just have
no,
to follow
designers
the script.
Go nuts with him. But ideally, there's designers who've worked with him before, so they know what to expect. But, you know, like the costume designers, they're not able to build half the costumes until... you know, half or three quarters of the rehearsal process is already over because we haven't decided, you know, what's going to happen. At some point, there's I'm Pericles and I'm in a new land and Simonides is the king there and there's a scene between the two of us. And so what was I going to wear? Well, we didn't know. And then I was talking to Mark and we said, well, what about if he's just coming back from the spa, you know, in this new land of which he's been embraced. And so, okay, good. We got a lovely bathrobe and the kind of slippers that you might find if you were at some 4-star place with an insignia on the back, which is Simonides' face. you know, these are all things that came late in the process, and then the costume people had to make that.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk back up a little bit about the plot itself. What happens in Pericles? It's kind of a classic story that one hears, but just give us a quick synopsis of the play, if you can.
Okay. Pericles is a young prince in Tyre, go figure. The play starts off in Antioch, where he is trying to win the hand of a young princess. He doesn't know that her father, who has created this riddle for all the knights, if they solve the riddle, then they get to her hand. If they don't, then they get their heads chopped off. It's kind of a raw deal. And he doesn't know, though, that the cards are really stacked against him and the game's rigged because the father is schtupping the daughter. And there's this terrible incest that's going on. That's in the riddle that Pericles is able to solve. It's a very easy riddle to solve. So here again is an example of how Mark, you know, had me solve it by all the writing on the riddle is backwards. But the beautiful actress's costume, as you remember, is covered with mirrors. And so I'm able to solve the riddle by reading the backwards letter in her dress,
right,
which is mirrored.
Pretty wild.
So anyway, I find that out. And then I know that Antiochus, the king, is going to want to kill me. And so I flee that land. I go back to Tyre and I say to my advisor, what do I do? What do I do? And she says, why don't you travel a while and get the hell out of here? And so off I go and I am shipwrecked and land on another land, meet another king and his daughter, and actually do win her hand. And we're going to live happily ever after, but I got to get back to Tyre. And on the ship back, she gives birth to a child and dies in childbirth. It's completely harrowing, and that's where that huge storm scene that you're talking about happens. And we send her off to sea in a coffin. Little do we know that she's not dead.
She's not really dead.
She's not really dead.
I'm not dead yet.
And she's going to wash up on shore and become a votaress, but I don't know that. And then I go back to another land and entrust my newborn into the hands of Queen Dionysa, thinking that all's going to be well and I'll come back for her later. Off I go. And then the plot starts to pick up with what happens with this young baby, who Marina, who grows up. And then Dionysa wants to get rid of her because she's jealous of her own daughters.
Needless to say, the opera drama continues and all works out at the end.
It does work out.
I don't want to say all is well that ends well, but no, that's a different play.
Well, to go back to the writing really quick, the reuniting scene between father and daughter is one of the more sublime pieces of writing in all of Shakespeare. So the play is actually not a comedy. I knew you mentioned that before. It's his first of what would later be called the romances, followed by Cymbeline and Winter's Tale and The Tempest. So he was actually exploring a new form, a new genre, which he would later on perfect in those other plays.
Also probably why we don't see Pericles as often in the repertory, because he did that kind of work better so much later.
He did, yeah. And it is a bit hodgepodgey. However, there are sections of the play that are just exquisite. And the reuniting scene between father and daughter, it could be a part of Lear, of any of Shakespeare's greatest work, which is really an honor and exciting to be able to do that.
I'm talking with David Barlow, who's starring as Pericles in the Berkeley reproduction of the same title. I mentioned, we talked about you're being sprayed with water every night. You're also painted with mud or some kind of a paint every night. Night after night, this happens to you now through May 26th. What is that like? I mean, it's a transformative experience every night, I imagine.
It has to be, because people are paying money. it's really important, I think, for us as actors to
You can't
remember.
Say, go easy on the mud tonight. Then that person in the audience needs to see the same amount of mud that
yeah.
first person
you know,
saw.
Shows are always going to be different, but your commitment should never waver. That's part of the job. And now, in terms of getting blasted with water, getting painted with the mud, like I said before, I actually appreciate those elements because it roots the action of theater in factual elements, which I, as a performer, really, really like.
You mentioned earlier that your rehearsal day will start with your fellow cast members playing Koosh ball. Excuse my ignorance there. Your fellow cast members include James Cameron, a man of many roles, especially here in the Bay Area. He was also a recent guest on Open Air, by the way. And Anita Carey, who's the person that mans the fire hoses that douses you in the Tempest scene. Anything else you want to mention about your cast, fellow cast members?
I love this ensemble. Everyone's been really game. And if you don't have that, especially in this kind of a process, you don't have that kind of bravery, then you're done for. And so the fact that everyone's stepped up and been so generous and taken on this challenge so willingly is fantastic.
Well, what's next for you then after Pericles?
I head back to New York, and then I'm going to team up with a company called PTP NYC that I've worked with before, and I'm going to be doing two plays in rep with each other. One is a Carol Churchill play called Serious Money, and the other is a Howard Barker play, this awesome British playwright, and his play is called The Castle. And so both of those playwrights in both plays are totally ferocious and it'll be a big challenge.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun and a lot of work that you got to do between those
yeah, hopefully. I should get a massage.
Well, enjoy the rest of the run of Pericles and let's hope for some downtime together sometime soon.
Oh, I did go to Point Reyes.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, it was amazing.
See what David is up to and his own running commentary on the run at Berkeley Rep at davidbarlow.org. How'd you get a .org, by the way? We'll have to talk about that sometime. David, thanks for taking
some time. There was no .com.
Oh, there you go. All right. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, David.
David Barlow is starring as Pericles, Prince of Tyre, in the Berkeley Rep production of the same name. It runs through May 26th. Catch it if you can. You're in for a terrific night of theater if you do. Tickets via berkeleyrep.org. It's there you can also grab tickets for the August production of Harold Pinter's No Man's Land, which will star Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen. berkeleyrep.org. Living under a rock, you're most likely aware that there's a new exploratorium in town. It is still the exploratorium, founded by physicist and educator Frank Oppenheimer, brother of Robert Oppenheimer, as an interactive playground of science and perception, recognized around the world as a prototype for a participatory museum experience. But instead of being headquartered in the Palace of Fine Arts, it's now between the Ferry Building and Fisherman's Wharf, with triple the space of the original. While the focus is on participating in science and discovery of the world around us, a great deal of attention has been focused on the building itself, more accurately a 21st century learning laboratory, now an inviting, eye-opening, playful place to explore and tinker. I'm very pleased to welcome Mark Letalian, design principal of the space, who has been involved in significant academic and public projects. Mark has been with Eschrich, Homsey, Dodge, and Davis, better known as EHDD Architecture, since 1990. EHDD is known especially for its sensitivity to place, technical innovation, and sustainable design, which we'll talk about. And it's been responsible for such interesting spaces as the Monterey Bay Aquarium and the Sea Ranch, garnering many awards for their work. Mark, welcome to KLW.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So let's start at the beginning. How does a project of this magnitude get started?
Well, it started for us back in the 90s. The Exploratorium noted that they needed to have more space. They had literally grown out of the Palace of Fine Arts and were starting to occupy buildings within the Presidio. So part of that was all about consolidating them back into one place. So we actually did a design for them back then, and then they made the decision to move. We helped them look at alternate spaces throughout the city. And then in 2004, they were able to strike a deal with the Port of San Francisco to land on Pier 15 and Pier 17.
That's quite a landing. Was the selection of firms competitive, or were you selected directly by the board?
Initially, we did participate in a competition. That was back in the 90s, and then when the decision was made to move, we just stayed with them.
Mm-hmm. One of the hallmarks of your firm, as I understand it, and to a certain degree must be obvious, is working closely with your clients in the design process. But you've also developed a methodology for doing so for such complex projects. How is your process different?
Well, I think we start from the very beginning. We start by identifying the key stakeholders and having meetings very early on, both in the institution and in our office. We have a reputation for being very good listeners. And I think once we we're able to establish what their needs really are. We have a better comfort level working with them, which allows us to have the group grow, the complexity of the project grows, and we're able to make a lot of progress that way.
Now, I'm wondering if that client interaction changes things in ways that you may not be entirely happy with.
Well, I think the Exploratorium, they are great conversationalists. I think they're people who are very inquisitive, and we had many, many conversations before we even put pencil to paper. And to us, that's what makes a project so exciting. But as a large institution, there are many different people to meet with, and sometimes some of those people have conflicting goals. So it's our job to get in there and hash it out with them and come up with a solution that meets everybody's needs.
Shepherd, as it were.
Yeah. Yeah.
How and to what degree, then, do the exhibits, either the new ones or the existing ones, inform your design process?
I think on this project, we understood that there were going to be a lot of exhibits that were moving from the Palace of Fine Arts, and we were very familiar with a lot of those exhibits. And our task was really to create the most flexible space we can to accommodate those exhibits. We also knew that a lot of those exhibits were going to be adapted, and a lot of new exhibits were going to be created. So in the case of the new exhibits,
you can't really foresee what those are going to be.
Yeah, and we worked probably a little bit more closely with the folks developing the new exhibits, because in some cases there was going to be some direct interaction with the architecture that needed to be planned in advance. So again, the name of the game is flexibility and really providing a canvas for those exhibits to really show the best.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it in the design or the exhibition where the decision was made to make the uncomfortable visitor drink from a water fountain shaped like a toilet?
That's pure Exploratorium. Okay. I wish I could take credit for that.
So what was the biggest problem you came across?
Oh, we had a number of challenges on the project. I think the one that comes to mind is the condition of the pier when we inherited it. Had been badly damaged in Loma Prieta. And we were working with Rutherford and Chikin, the structural engineers, to develop a concept for how to really make this pier a safe place to be. And there's over 15,000 pilings supporting that pier. We were able to repair about a third of them and introduce 30 what we call mega piles that are on the four corners of the pier that really help brace it and keep it from moving laterally. Those are all tied together with an 8-inch concrete slab over the existing slab, which really makes for a very, very strong substructure.
Hmm. Did it come out exactly as you planned? Any surprises along the way?
No surprises with that. I think what was unusual for us is spending that much time on the substructure of a building. For almost the first year of construction, we had over 30 divers on site working round the clock on the tide cycles, and all the work was happening beneath the surface of the water. So it didn't look like a lot of progress was being made up on top, and that gradually changed.
The underneath of the Exploratorium is key to the functioning of the building, I understand. Now, the new location features an 800-foot-long structure extending over San Francisco Bay, adds 1.5 acres of publicly accessible waterfront space, and added two pedestrian bridges, making it possible to circumambulate Pier 15. There has been a lot of talk about the sustainable design of the building. Now, for those not up on the architecture lingo and process, talk to me about what LEED is and what being a LEED-certified building entails.
LEED is set up by the U.S. Green Building Council, and it's a system of establishing criteria and points for evaluating the sustainability of a building. There's a mandate for LEED Silver for buildings in the city. We were able to exceed that and do a LEED Gold building. For us, going beyond LEED was really critical, and we wanted to develop a project that was based on performance. And that's where the net zero energy building discussion began, and that was jointly agreed upon with the client, our consultants, fairly early on in the process.
Now, these are voluntary ways of design. Is that correct? It's not mandated or required at this point.
And the net zero energy building portion is completely voluntary.
Mm-hmm. And what does being a net zero building entail? Are you off the grid completely? Do you contribute to the grid?
We are on the grid, but essentially what we're doing is we're creating as much power on site as we're consuming. And that's a big thing. That's a very difficult thing to do.
Especially for such a large space.
Exactly. A lot of net zero energy buildings have been done in this country. There's an increasing amount. But most of them with a few exceptions, are fairly small buildings. So this is one of the larger ones.
Mm-hmm. So why aren't all new buildings designed in this way? Is it a cost prohibitive process or more a mindset that has to change in the aspect of the builders and designers?
I think with net zero energy buildings, one of the things that we've learned is, first and foremost, you have to start with a super energy efficient building. And when you do that, what ends up happening is more and more of the total energy consumption of the building goes to what's known as plug loads. It's all those things that you plug into the wall. And those are a little bit less predictable. And with a lot of clients, we do monitoring of what they have in place. In the case of Exploratorium, we actually set up 2,000 monitoring points throughout the building to find out where the energy was being consumed. And this is going to be very helpful in the first year as we try to track energy consumption to be able to identify where the problem areas are. So the idea is that you work for an entire year and try to see where the results are. We're very confident that we can reach our goal, and we're very hopeful that we can reach our goal within the first year. If we don't, we know where to find the problems. And what's really great about the Exploratorium is that they will share that information and they will make really great exhibits out of that. So it'll be something that everybody can benefit from and raise the bar.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the use of seawater and how that process even works.
Sure. The fact that we're building on the bay is a fascinating thing for me. We're literally in the front porch of the city, right on the Embarcadero. We have two buildings right over the water, and the Exploratorium now has an outdoor presence like they never had before. And they're using that connectivity to the water for exhibits about the bay and about the city. And more importantly, we're actually able to use actual seawater to heat and cool the building.
Heat and cool the building.
Heat and cool the building. So the advantage of San Francisco Bay is that the temperature swing through the course of the year isn't great. It's like 15 degrees. So we're able to use it as thermal mass. So you can tap into the temperature of the water. And we've pumped in, we have a closed loop inside the building which runs in the concrete slabs of over 40 miles of plastic pipe that runs fresh water through the building, which helps climatize the building. And there's all sorts of advantages to that in terms of not having to rely so much on conventional systems with big ducts, cooling towers, and all these things that are typically associated with the building of the scale of the Exploratorium.
So is the heat and the cooling all in the flooring, or is it in the walls? Is it every part of the building?
Most of it happens in the floors. We do have ducts overhead where we circulate fresh air, and there is some thermal control with that, but the majority of it is happening beneath your feet.
Tell us about the public access around the pier.
This is, to me, one of the most fascinating aspects of this project, because we're working with a pier that is 820 feet long. That's about the size of a New York City block from avenue to avenue. And to be able to provide the general public the ability to get to the very end of that pier, to us, was a great challenge.
Now, this is for the paying public once they're inside the Exploratorium, or just public access in general?
No, it's actually general public who haven't necessarily purchased a ticket to the Exploratorium. To us, it's a great benefit to be able to have the public walk between the two piers and engage in the exhibits that the Exploratorium has created, walk across the bridge, walk all the way to the end toward the Fisher Bay Observatory, and look out over the edge of the railing. When you get that far offshore, you kind of leave the city behind. The views all become about the bay, the sounds become about the bay, the smells are all about the bay, and it's a really unique experience to be able to be on the end. And once you get there, the special bonus is you have access to Sea Glass Restaurant, and that's open to the general public. And the public can actually walk all the way around the entire pier and into parts of the inside of the building, which was a very deliberate and strategic. When you walk in the building, you're actually hearing the sounds of the Exploratorium. You're seeing exhibits. You're seeing kids. You're seeing adults really engaged with the exhibits. So if you don't know anything about the Exploratorium, you can be hooked.
Exactly. Right? So it's built-in PR just going for a walk around the pier. That's great.
Absolutely.
Brilliant. Now, speaking of that other pier, I know there's plans to expand further into Pier 17. Where are you in that process, and what will be in that space?
Right now, the Exploratorium has their export shop in Pier 17. for those listeners who don't know, the Exploratorium exports many of their exhibits to science centers all over the world. Probably 80% of the science centers all over the world use some form of Exploratorium exhibit. Those are now going to be made inside Pier 17. There are no immediate plans for renovating Pier 17, but when it does happen in the future, it's quite possible that exhibits will end up in that pier. We haven't really gone through the planning that far to determine exactly what that'll be. And in the meantime, they'll be leasing the space that they don't use.
But it'll be your baby once the plans move forward.
I certainly hope so.
There you go. What's at the Exploratorium that you want to make sure we see?
If I had to identify one piece of the project that I think is really notable and worth seeing, it's the Fisher Bay Observatory at the end. It's an interesting little pavilion. It has a number of different functions. I think urbanistically what it does is it, by sitting between these two piers, it really helps envelop this open plaza and make it more of a big outdoor room instead of it just being two finger piers. That was very helpful to us in trying to establish not only the outdoor exploratorium space, but this path of visitor access around the pier that we were talking about earlier. The primary motivation for that pavilion was, it's called an observatory, it's for looking out. And we designed it with that mindset. We worked with the exhibit curators, scientists, and artists that work within the Exploratorium to develop a space that had fabulous views looking out toward the bay and looking back toward the city. And it's a very flexible space. It can adapt to not only exhibits, but to special events. And it's a nice little gem at the end of the pier. It's a very honest building, reflective. And a really nice terminus to that vista when you're walking along the Embarcadero and you happen upon Pier 15 and 17. It gives you some reason to go to the end.
Sure. Well, at exploratorium.edu, you can browse hundreds of webcasts, video clips, podcasts, slideshows from the Exploratorium's collection of original programming, from remote scientific expeditions around the world to fun hands-on activities. You can also see some of the behind-the-scenes videos of the physical plant of the building and how that unique seawater system works throughout the building. And when you do visit Pier 15, and I'm sure you will, you can indeed drink deep from the water fountain shaped like a toilet. You can sit in a chair holding a spinning bicycle wheel, wear a set of headphones that seems to swap your right and left ears, see a classic example of a pinhole camera obscura, climb into a kaleidoscope if you'd like, and enjoy a panoramic view of the San Francisco Bay. But when you do, look at the larger space around you as well and thank Mark Letalian. The Italian and the Tulip, what do you know? For radio first, I think. Mark, thanks for taking some time to visit with us here at KLW. And we look forward to your design of the new KLW studios. Pro bono, of course.
Of course. Thank you, David.
A few weeks back, I talked with a cast member who portrays Frankie Valli of the musical Jersey Boys, but today I'm pleased to welcome a true Jersey boy, born in Montclair, but making a career with a very different type of singing. Operatic tenor Michael Fabiano has been singing this week with the San Francisco Symphony under Michael Tilson Thomas for their mini Beethoven Fest, singing in Missa Solemnis this weekend, and a second performance tonight of the rarely heard song cycle, An die Ferne Geliebte. He returns to the Met in New York in December to sing the role of Alfred in a new production of Johann Strauss's Die Fledermaus, with lots of operatic stops en route. And yesterday celebrated his 29th birthday. Michael, welcome to KLW.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And happy birthday.
Thank you.
You've had some recent debuts in Seattle, Ottawa, an American Recital debut in Kansas City. You've sung in some of the most important, prominent opera houses in the world already. And just this week, making your San Francisco Symphony debut. Things are going kind of well, I think.
Yeah, they are. Thank you.
Where is home these days? It must be a rare sight.
Home is in my luggage.
What one would think.
Yeah, I have an apartment in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and I've maintained a house there because I went to school at the Academy of Vocal Arts there for 4 years. And for me, it's close enough to where my family lives in New Jersey, and so when I'm home, I get and hop in my car and drive up to Hoboken or wherever else my family lives in the northern part of the state. Most of my friends tend to live in New York, but I like to go to New York for a few days. I like to relax a little more in Philly.
Uh-huh.
and I can get a little more bang for my buck there.
Well, you're working in all kinds of languages, but one of the first thing that popped out to me in your telling me where you lived is that you have an apartment in Philadelphia. So is that a struggle for you to overcome some of the Jerseyness in your sound?
Would you like me to talk like a normal person? You want me to talk like I'm from Kansas? I'd be glad to if you like.
Is it a challenge for you to, or is it every language its own ball of wax?
No, I speak Italian pretty fluently. I studied Spanish for 10 years, so I speak Spanish well. And I never really studied French, but because I've worked in Paris and I've worked in other cities in France with other symphonies, I've learned the language pretty efficiently. And I also, my primary coach that I work with is from Normandy. And, I mean, sometimes we even conduct my lessons in French. So I've kind of learned the French language as well as I can without ever having taken a class in it. So I speak some languages, and I think for an opera singer, I think it's very important to have some sort of fluency in the romantic languages. And year by year, it gets better and better for me.
Sure. Now, this amazing fast-track trajectory, is this directly attributable to your being the 2007 grand prize winner of the Metropolitan Opera National Council auditions?
I think that was a starting point. I don't think it's a slingshot because of it. I think there are milestones that I've had. And I think there have been milestones because of different people that have believed in me at different periods of time. So, for instance, I won the Met in 2007, and that led to me having a few major engagements around the world. I made my debut at La Scala in 2008. People knew about it. But I had two big moments at the English National Opera in 2009 and 11, and then here at the San Francisco Opera in Lucrezia Borgia with Rene Fleming in 2011. And then really recently, I had a wonderful evening at Avery Fisher Hall doing the opera I Lombardi on April 8th, just a few weeks ago. That was a really big night for me and a really special night that I will remember forever.
Well, that's fantastic. Let's back up just briefly about the process that led to your winning the Metropolitan Opera National Council auditions. It was featured in a documentary that shows the good, bad, and ugly about the process called The Audition. And I was reading some about your subsequent competition wins. Now, what's the motivation for further competitions? I would think that the Met is the golden ring.
That's a good question. I think for young singers, competitions are not necessarily about, there's not one overarching competition that can launch a career. And the motivation for singers to enter competitions is not necessarily career launch. It's really, truly income. And, you know, with a lot of these competitions, there are large purses for first and second prize. And for a young singer who usually does not have engagements or contracts at that point, winning a purse of $5,000 or $10,000 or $8,000, you know, collecting a few of those checks over a period, you know, over a year is a way of basically putting some money in the bank and paying rent. And that's basically what I did until I was 25 to make money.
It's essential. I mean, you have a team of people that have to maintain your voice and
sure,
keep your career moving forward.
I mean, it costs a lot of money to take lessons and coachings, and being an opera singer may seem glamorous to people on the outside, but it's a lot of work and a lot of expense for the performer, especially the more career moves, the more expensive it gets. So there's always factors that factor into why. So, yeah, as much as the Met was a golden ring of sorts, there are other competitions that provided as much money for, you know, grand prizes as the Met did. That was a nice bonus.
Mm-hmm. If you're interested in seeing that fascinating documentary, The Audition, it's well worth checking out on Netflix, however you can see it. You can see a fascinating process. It's a major, major ordeal for one, and it's a major accomplishment. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I understand that you come from a very musical family, operatic, in fact, so this type of music must have been a part of your psyche from early on. But was a singing career early in your game plan?
No, not at all. Yes, it's true that my family is very musical, and I grew up listening to a lot of classical music. You know, I'm doing this Beethoven festival right now, but my father happens to be a Beethoven fanatic. And he's going to be in heaven because he's going to see the Fourth Symphony, which I believe is his favorite of all of the symphonies.
Fantastic.
But I didn't conceive an operatic career until I got to college. I intended to go to business school. Only after the pushing of my first voice teacher, George Shirley, when he said, Michael, you have a talent and people with a talent have a responsibility to that talent. And it kind of clicked. And I'm a person that drives hard for success. And once I kind of had the confidence that I had something, I haven't stopped.
So here you are in San Francisco, not singing opera. Now, how did you get involved in Beethoven's An die Ferne Geliebte? Was this piece even on your radar?
It was not. I can say that after my performances of Lucrezia Borgia at the San Francisco Opera in September, October of 2011, I had some contact with Maestro Tilson Thomas, and we built a project and together, and he included me in a project that was for Beethoven, and I didn't know what the terms initially were going to be, but then I found out that it was pairing An die Ferne Geliebte with some other things, and then would you come sing the Missa Solemnis in tandem with that, and it turned into just a nice extended period of work for me here, mm-hmm. and a really cool project of doing a number of these Beethoven. He has the project where the An die Ferne Geliebte is, he has a wonderful quartet of trombones that are doing a 5-minute piece of music.
That's very obscure piece of chamber music. It really
but
is.
It's wonderful. It's magnificent. It starts off the concert. It's something that people should really come and listen to.
How did that association start with Michael Tilson Thomas then, and you're subsequently being invited out here?
Well, we had contact, as I said, right after my performances, and it was a very generous contact, and I just kept in contact with the symphony through my manager, and we organized an arrangement.
Fantastic. Now, this song cycle is definitely in the shadow of the song and the song cycle master Franz Schubert, Beethoven's younger and more prominent contemporary in the song
sure.
department. What is the song cycle about for people that don't know it?
Well, it's about, I would say, a pensive man, a man that is waiting or knowing that his love is gone for a period of time, and she's across the mountains. It's a very ethereal piece of music. It's very detail-oriented. And unlike a lot of other song cycles, it's not a straight line in time. It's not a timeline. Each song doesn't go in order. It's kind of like a circle of information, and we get back to the beginning. The first song basically is repeated at the end in the sixth song. And the man, the gentleman talking about his love, is talking about wishing she were here and how it aches him that she's gone. And he does it in a number of very poetic ways. But we can't really identify how long this person's been gone and why she's gone, just so much as he misses her.
This is performed in the classic way with you and a pianist. I understand your collaborative artist on this is John Churchwell. Not the first time you've worked with John.
No. I worked with John in 2007 when I was preparing for the Metropolitan Opera National Council Editions, and he was my pianist through the semifinal round. And so I've known him for a while, and I knew him at the staff at the San Francisco Opera when I was doing Lucrezia Borgia as well, and he's a nice confidant of mine, so I'm glad to work with him. I'm also doing a big project with him on May 23rd at the Mondavi Center. He's going to be my pianist for my recital debut there, at UC Davis, and I'm really excited about that as well.
Well, from the first official song cycle ever written, with its poetic imagery of mist-shrouded hills and pensive forests and unattainable love, you're also singing as one of the featured soloists in the Missa Solemnis, a much more familiar work to many, and much more historically prominent in Beethoven's output.
Yes.
Now, while not operatic, it certainly involves a need to communicate closely with your collaborative artists, your fellow soloists. How do you find those differences in working in something like a Missa Solemnis versus another choral work in front of an audience with a chorus behind you?
Well, I am a soloist in front of a chorus.
Right.
I mean, there's a chorus behind me. The Missa Solemnis is a technically difficult piece of music, not vocally, but musically it's complex, and you know we've been remarking throughout the rehearsal process that Beethoven has a number of harmonic progressions in this score that are very strange and very different, and basically harken the future of what a lot of romantic or classical romantic music ended up becoming, and it's been a tough work to learn and study, And
are these your first performances?
Yes, it's the first time I've ever done the Missa Solemnis. It's not vocally hard so much as it's just a challenge musically, something that I've not really experienced before.
And you have a fantastic chorus behind you prepared by Ragnar Bohm, San Francisco Symphony Chorus, MTT conducting, of course. Fantastic performances coming.
Oh, it's a wonderful experience, and the chorus is wonderful. I got to experience them yesterday for the first time, and they sound terrific.
Working with Michael Tilson-Thomas on the Missa Solemnis, did he bring something to the work that you weren't quite aware of, or what was his approach to the Beethoven that might have given you some new thoughts, some new insight?
Texture and layer. Sometimes when I learn music, I learn it very technically, and I learn the notes, the values of the notes, and that's it, especially with music like this that's very complex. But what's helped me with him is that he's encouraged me to have a different palette of dynamics and range in my colors and shading of words as I go through the music that I didn't contemplate before I was studying it. When I was studying it privately, and that has helped me actually kind of saturate the music that is tough in my brain a little better. So I appreciate it.
Best of luck with these Beethoven concerts and up at UC Davis, and thanks for taking a little bit of time to talk with us today.
Thank you very much.
Michael Fabiano sings with the San Francisco Symphony tonight in a program that includes Michael Tilson-Thomas conducting. We'll have John Churchwell on the piano for Beethoven's rarely heard song cycle An die Ferne Geliebte, an odd chamber work for four trombones, and Beethoven's Symphony No. 4, as well as the Beethoven-inspired Absolute Jest by John Adams, which incorporates more than a half dozen Beethoven fragments, mostly from his late string quartets. Tomorrow and Saturday, it's the Missa Solemnis with fellow soloists Laura Claycomb, Sasha Cook, and Shen Yang. Details at sfsymphony.org. A great site to check out, by the way, prior to your visit, because, you know, the program notes are there, all the things that you can read up on, because if you're like me, you usually don't get to those when you're chatting with your friends on the evening of the concert. He'll also be performing up in recital at the Mondavi Center for the Performing Arts at UC Davis on May 23rd. Learn more about the star track of Michael's career, which in the 2013-14 season will include the great role of Edgardo in Lucia de Lammermoor at the Opera Bastille in Paris, and the challenging title role in a new production of Gounod's Faust at the Nederlands Opera. You'll learn that at michaelfabianotenor.com. Chances are he wouldn't mind you liking him on Facebook as well. Here he is singing from another epic choral work from the Verdi Requiem in Gemisco.
In Gemisco tamquam reus culparubet vultus me. Oh!
Tenor Michael Fabiano with the Oslo Philharmonic, Jussi-Pekka Saraste conducting just last month in March. From the music of Verdi to the world of cabaret and beyond, for a special concluding segment with Peter Robinson.
What good is sitting alone in your room? Or come hear the music play? Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Put down the knitting, the book and the broom. It's time for a holiday. Life is a cabaret, old chum. So come to
Welcome
the
Welcome back,
cabaret.
Peter. What do you have for us today?
Well, life is a cabaret, old chum, but it's very, very difficult to find around town nowadays. The Raz Room had a variation on cabaret, but that style has now closed, and they've actually opened a new show, which I'll have a bit more to say later, with Michael Feinstein's club, based on the Michael Feinstein Club in New York. But when I look at that song, which, of course, came from the music cabaret, it made me check out the history, because there was something dynamic, there was something humorous, there was something political, there was certainly something satirical about the historic nature of cabaret. And prior to the I Am a Camera, the book on which cabaret was actually based in France, it had been functioning ever since the days of Montmartre at Le Chat Noir, the Black Cat, then moved on to the Moulin Rouge. And, of course, people may know the Moulin Rouge through the paintings of Toulouse-Lautrec, but certainly through the sad, difficult, but memorable songs of Edith Piaf. It got more glorified in the immediate post-World War II period in 1947 with the opening of the Lido. Edith Piaf again appeared there, but also they brought in other international artists, Shirley MacLaine, Marlene Dietrich, Maurice Chevalier, and, of course, Noel Coward. Now, when we look at cabaret, different countries have put their own impact and their own imprint on what it means. Certainly in England in the 1960s, at the Establishment Club, this finally gave way to Beyond the Fringe. And in a sense, some of the Monty Python material, which is humorous, satirical and pointed, has that element of cabaret. In terms of this country, New York continued it in the 60s, still more music emphasized with Nina Simone, Eartha Kitt, Peggy Lee. And then by the late 60s, we were over in Las Vegas at the Tropicana, where, again, you got a different version of cabaret. Noel Coward, in fact, did one of his last appearances at the Sands in Las Vegas. But today, it's actually hard to find genuine cabaret. I have a couple of theories. To some extent, the television programs with Colbert and Stewart have partly satirized the nature of news. Saturday Night Live has elements of what you might have found at the original type of cabaret, which combines both music and comedy. And then when we come back to the city here, probably Beach Blanket Babylon, which is still babbling on and still going at the Club Fugazi, gives that sense of being at a cabaret. But let's go back to the Raz Rooms, because I remember a memorable evening, which is even before the Raz Rooms, at the Plush Rooms. And we had a Noel Coward dedication, which Alan Foley headed up. And to me, strangely enough, that was a combination of cabaret. Cabaret involves listening. And sometimes when you're having your drinks, eating your dinner, and you've got a nice singer, the chit-chat at the background not only kills the performance, But with cabaret, you want to catch the satire, you want to hear the jokes, you want to understand what the purpose is.
I think that's why we can't really call the space Martoonies a cabaret space, because it's so loud and people aren't, you know, there's a focus on some of these singers, some of which are performing in the city, but it's they're distracted by the outside noises, of course.
That's right, yeah, yeah. If there's too much ambience, too much noise, and sometimes they do this deliberately to catch that kind of New York buzz, it actually kills the performance because you don't know why you're there, what you're there, and then by then somebody spilled a drink all over you. So that's how it ends. But at the Razz Rooms, we have had a minor revival with Michael Feinstein. I'm not sure how it's going to end. And Mitzi Gaynor, who's now aged 81, is giving it out. We will see where this takes us. But I would like to put a note in for a revival of cabaret as we used to know it, even with the jugglers, the mimes, that whole sense of theatre, political theatre, with a bite, with a message, very much come to the cabaret. So I thought, as a tribute to Mitzi Gaynor, we may go out with Anything Goes, because nowadays, when it comes to cabaret, let's face it, anything goes.
Thank you, Peter. Indeed, Mitzi Gaynor will be at Feinstein's at Nico on the 15th, 16th, 17th, and 18th of this month. You can get information via ticketweb.com or search for Feinstein's at Nico on your browser. Not the easiest website they have, so just give it a little search. Feinstein's at Nico, you'll find it here. A couple of things to clean up shop here. I'd like to thank my producer, Niels Swinkels, for helping make things happen here. And a reminder that KLW is listener-supported. We're keeping our Shorter is Better drive alive. We'll hear something from that in just a moment. You've been listening to Open Air, and here is the great Mitzi Gaynor, some classic Mitzi Gaynor on KLW's Open Air.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes. Good authors, too, who once knew better words, now only use three-letter words, writing prose. Anything goes. The world has gone mad today, and good's bad today, and black's white today, and day's night today, when most guys today that women prize today are just silly gigolos. So if romance is what you crave, and don't sit on your hands behaving like Eskimos, anything goes. Wrestlers go to drama classes to learn how to please the masses on TV shows. Anything goes.